The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Now, space is a cold, unforgiving and deathly quiet place. But while sound itself may not travel in a vacuum, there are actually radio waves and signals coming from all corners of the universe to us here on Earth, causing quite a lot of noise in the night sky. And while we know where most of these signals come from, there are some that astronomers are scratching their heads as to what they might be. Vikram Ravi is Assistant Professor of Astronomy at Caltech, and he joins me now. Welcome to the program, Vikram. Can you tell us a little bit about these fast radio bursts and what we know about them?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me. This is a really exciting program to be part of. So, yeah, these fast radio bursts, we've been studying them now for over a decade. They were first picked up in archival sort of recordings made by radio telescopes back in 2007. And then since then, we've slowly fine-tuned our instrumentation to be able to pick them up at ever-increasing rates. And so what do they actually look like? Well, that's the thing. They happen extremely fast. They just last a millisecond. But when they're on, they're some of the brightest sources in the radio sky. If you could see the sky with radio eyes, every so often, roughly 1,000 times over the day, you would see these intense flashes of radiation from different parts of space. So we now have recorded about 100 of these events, and about 10 of them have been pinpointed to extremely distant galaxies. And so we actually know that some of these certainly come from galaxies extremely far away.
What do we know about the sources, and what sort of hypotheses have been put forward?
So this has been an ongoing effort by the theoretical community in our field. So for a long time, the running joke was that there were more theories for what make fast radio bursts than there were actually recorded events. And so up till about 2 years ago, there were about 50 events and well over 50 types of theories. And so originally, the theories ranged quite widely, all the way from exploding mini black holes to merging neutron stars, to merging white dwarfs merging with neutron stars colliding with asteroids, neutron stars having so-called star quakes, sometimes even jets being launched by black holes towards us, the collapse of a neutron star to a black hole, and so on and so on and so on. Now, there are some things that really do refine these theories. One of them is the fact that the bursts are so short. So for something to happen that is so short in time, the region from which it comes must actually be smaller than the time it takes light to cross it.
How do you know that?
Because if that's not the case, it's hard to imagine that a burst could be emitted from different regions which don't know about each other at the same time. Right. Why would it be that one part of the source that has no clue what's going on in the other part of the source decides to emit at exactly the same time?
Quantum entanglement. That's a joke. That's a joke.
So we hope. No, so that sort of limits the size of the emitting region to the distance light can travel in about a millisecond, which is a few hundred kilometers. And so that tells us that the emitting regions are extremely small. And the other thing that we know about this is that the emission is extremely intense. If we put these things at these distant extragalactic locations, then we know that the total energy output is something like what the sun emits in about 100 years. So
wow.
The entire energy the sun puts out in 100 years is released in radio waves in a millisecond.
When we talk about something regular, I can't see how that would be caused by a single event. I mean, I can see how it might be caused by the spinning of something or the orbiting of something, but I can't see how a singular event would give continuous and regular bursts. That's the thing about these things, right? They are regular. You could almost set your clock to the regularity of these bursts. Isn't that right?
Kind of.
So, really?
So this is actually, again, very much an open question. And so if we just ignore where the bursts come from and just ask, okay, we're seeing the sky with radio eyes, what are the various things we see? So first of all, we see a bunch of things called pulsars. So pulsars within the Milky Way emit bursts very much like fast radio bursts, except that they are clearly within the Milky Way because they show much less signs of having traveled through space. The characteristic delays in the signal are much less, which means that they're clearly within the Milky Way. Now, pulsars are extremely regular. They're some of the, they actually over timescales of decades, they are about as good as the best clocks on Earth. That regularity is because of their rotation, because every time they rotate, they emit a pulse. Now, fast radio bursts, most of them have never been observed to repeat. Some have been observed to repeat incredibly often, and now two actually appear to repeat relatively regularly. So the bursts actually appear in small windows every, in one case, 16 days, and another case, about every 150 days.
Right. Okay. So that was a misunderstanding on my behalf. So that makes it even more curious a puzzle, doesn't it? Because further away pulsars or something happening with to do with an orbit would make sense. But if it's sort of on and off again every once in a while, you can see why some people initially thought, could this be signs of life?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so...
Is it a message from somewhere?
That's right. I mean, I think the biggest issue with that idea is now that we've actually pinpointed many of them to distant galaxies, the energies involved are just completely beyond our concept of any sort of life form.
How massive would an object need to be to release this sort of energy from so far away?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So, first of all, we don't really know what the mechanism is by which these bursts are emitted. In fact, we don't really have any physical theory for any mechanism that can emit this much energy in this short a time. And so, the simplest possibility that one can think of is this idea of and it sounds strange to say this is the simplest possibility, but a very clean possibility rather, is this idea of a black hole evaporating. So you have a black hole that is losing mass to so-called Hawking radiation discovered by Stephen Hawking, and eventually it starts to have runaway mass loss and collapses and releases its mass effectively as energy. Now, this mass is released initially as charged particles, which then will radiate in the interstellar magnetic fields of whichever galaxy this black hole is sitting in. Now, the actual mass of these black holes that could then evaporate and cause fast radio burst-like emission would have to be something like the mass of the Earth. That's a good enough number to remember that. Imagine a black hole, the mass of the Earth, evaporating. That's about right to cause a fast radio burst. But you've got to convert the entire thing into energy, convert the entire Earth into this form of radio waves. And that's certainly a very hard thing to do.
Again, if that happened, would it explain intermittent bursts of energy? Do these bursts of energy go up and down?
Yeah, that's the thing. So, as you've rightly said, it's very difficult to explain repeating sources of fast radio bursts with a mechanism like that. I mean, you can't. It's hard enough to imagine one Earth kind of being converted into a fast radio burst, let alone many. And so, certainly, some possibilities that people have raised are a neutron star colliding with a series of asteroids as it moves through some sort of an asteroid belt. That's one way of doing this. But certainly the fact that some of these things now appear to have these periodicities in when the bursts occur, that the bursts typically occur in these short windows of time around much larger periodicities, like 16 days in one case. That is a bit difficult to explain with these sort of so-called cataclysmic scenarios, these sort of explosive scenarios. Instead, we think about, as you said, rotation or something orbiting.
It sounds to me that the theoretical physicists are having great fun with this. It's sort of like celebrity deathmatch of astrophysical bodies, you know? Like, let's see if we get a white dwarf smashing into a neutron star and that gets eaten by a black hole. Does that give us what we want? No. All right, let's tag team something else. It sounds like quite a fun thing to do, to try and recreate this signature by using theoretical models of these enormous things out there in the deepest, darkest edges of space. One of the ideas is that it could be something to do with magnetar. Now, this is a new word for me, so I'm all ears. What is a magnetar and how could it create some of these fast radio bursts?
Okay, so magnetars, I mean, it's a fun-sounding name and they're definitely fun objects. Magnetars have the most extreme magnetic fields in the universe. Their magnetic fields are something like 1 with 14 zeros after it, stronger than the magnetic field of the sun. They're incredibly strong magnetic fields. Now, magnetars are actually neutron stars, just like pulsars are neutron stars as well. Neutron stars in general are thought to be the sort of collapsed remnants of the supernovae of massive stars. So when a star explodes, its core collapses in on itself, and the gravity is so strong that it overcomes the forces that keep atoms, and smushes the electrons and protons together to form a ball of neutrons, hence the term neutron star.
I love these things. The neutron stars are my favorite thing in the universe, although I haven't heard of magnetars. These are the things that are so dense that if you had a matchbox worth of neutron star in your hand, it would weigh about 3 billion tons. These are extraordinarily perfect circles of matter. They are wonderful objects. So yeah. Magnetar is a type of neutron star.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's your theory on this then? What do you think they are? Have you got a favorite hypothesis?
It keeps changing, unfortunately. So the picture that we have is like this. We now have something like 10 events that have been pinpointed to individual galaxies. We've also observed that something like 1 in 20 to 1 in 50 have observable repeat events, but even those that don't have not yet been observed to repeat. There is no reason to think that they won't repeat given enough time. The galaxies to which they've been localized, they vary wildly from galaxies that are 10,000 times smaller than the Milky Way to galaxies somewhat bigger than the Milky Way. The locations within galaxies also vary rather wildly. And so the picture is of an extremely common type of progenitor object, an extremely common type of source that can occur in almost any environment, but in some cases may be biased towards environments that form stars rapidly. Now, when you're forming stars rapidly, they must also be exploding as supernovae rather rapidly. And so what that tells us is that we may well be observing relatively young sources. That, combined with the constraints we mentioned before on the size of the emitting region as well as the energy, that points you towards neutron stars, and in particular, magnetars. And so I would say that young magnetars are my favorite hypothesis. Exactly how the emission is generated is still an open question, whether it is some sort of an explosion on the surface that drives a shock wave into the surrounding medium, or whether it's simply an explosion that drives some sort of a blob of charged particles through the intense magnetic fields is not really clear.
Yeah.
But I would say young magnetars. The really interesting question then.
Young Magnetars is also a fantastic name for a band. So I love it. Vikram Ravi from Caltech, thank you so much for joining
us. Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
So as always on the live show, we ask you to put your comments and texts and tweets into the podcast because we can just deal with them and just, we can sort of stretch our legs a little bit if we want to. And if not, we can just dismiss them with single word responses. So we talked about volcanoes and the alarm systems. We spoke to Shane Cronin from New Zealand about how we might predict them better. Valeria Nicolosi tweeted, she said, "I was born and lived most of my life at the feet of the highest and most active volcano in Europe, Etna. Earthquakes and continuous eruptions were normality. Stunning nature. Miss my Etna." Well, it, I'm glad you didn't say there. That's all I'll say, Valeria, who happens also to be one of our most decorated and awarded researchers. She's literally had loads of European research awards. So we're very glad she lives in Ireland. We were talking about disappearing stars and speaking to a young PhD astronomer who was looking at a star from a galaxy far, far away that just seemed to disappear. And we were trying to find out why that happened. And someone says, this happened millions of years ago. No. And I guess, is the point of that that we shouldn't care about it? Or are they talking about the speed of light and how long it took to get here?
I think it's a speed of light thing, because Alan...
I see. This is old. I'm only into new stuff.
It was because Andrew was saying that, you know, it probably happened in... I can't remember when the window was. There was a window when they weren't looking at it, which was in the early 2000s, I think. Yeah, but he was saying it probably happened then. The observation would have happened then. But because it was 75 million light years away, it actually happened 75 million years ago, which is mental.
Yeah, I know. I always find it weird. I find it difficult to process the million light years away sort of thing. Light year still kind of gets me as...
Yeah, I know they have very good telescopes.
I've only been doing it for like, you know, 10 years, but I'm still like, wait, what is it?
How can we see something that far away? It doesn't make any sense. Like, how many lenses are on this telescope?
Yeah, exactly. This is a really long telescope. We were also talking about... political ads and how, according to research, they're not as effective as we've been led to believe. Colm says, I'm just listening to the podcast from last week. The first story on the news was about political ads, and Root said that there was just a tiny effect from the ads. She said the candidates were seen more favorably, but by just a tiny amount. She said it was on 0.5 of a 5-point scale. 0.5 on a 5-point scale is 10%. Most elections are won and lost on far less than that, particularly so in US presidential elections where the margins can be really tight. If I was a presidential candidate and someone told me that TV ads could change by my polling by 10%, I'd jump at that. Look, number one, it is tricky always to remember the numbers when you're live recording. But even if that's true, I believe she said that was only in a very specific case, but for the most part, there wasn't any significant shift, is my memory without listening back to it. But yeah, look, I mean, even if it's two people, I mean, that was the no. I remember seeing the Hillary. Have you seen the Hillary documentary?
I haven't actually, no.
It's very good. It makes you, although it does make you sad on your insides, because all the things you thought about Hillary, you kind of go, oh crap, I'm a bad person for thinking all those things. And being, and also just being gullible. And, you know, the reason why she wasn't very likable, the reason why she didn't seem very authentic, all the stuff that they threw up, there's a reason for it all. And it's in the documentary. And at the end of it, you just go, oh my God, America was robbed. But in some of the constituencies they were talking about, a gap of literally sometimes just two votes. So, any sway is obviously important, particularly this year. But I think what they're saying is we thought it was a much bigger swing. At least certainly we were led to believe from recent news reports and all the brouhaha about Cambridge Analytica that this was basically, you could just, you know, send someone a few ads and turn them from an ardent Obama supporter to a Trump supporter. And then we don't read these out very often, Aidan, but I think, will we read this one? Like,
I think this was so nice that it made my whole day.
Yeah. Okay. So this is from Paula Gavin, and she's got a master's of education, HRCE. So she's a qualified educator. She's from Our Lady Queen of the Apostles National School. And she says, I would just like to thank you for the wonderful work you're doing to promote science, to make it accessible and interesting, and to always ask interesting and comprehensive and comprehensible questions of those you interview. As a primary school teacher of EEC, 40 years with a great interest in teaching science. Your program keeps me energized, focused, and keen to learn more about science and to teach more and hopefully encourage my pupils to enjoy science and perhaps study it at a later stage. An ex-pupil is currently studying astrophysics, so I like to think I might have ignited a spark there. Your interviews are always insightful and intelligent. Your interviews are insightful and intelligent, I can't even read, and lack ego or appear to. Congratulations on the tremendous work you do. Keep it up. All good wishes, Paula. Well, Paula, thank you so much. What a wonderful email to get. And Aidan will stand testament to my lack of ego. I'm very easy to work with.
The lack of ego is just very, very fine editing.
It's suffocating. The lack of ego is suffocating, isn't it?
Yes.
Paula, thank you so much. And to all of those people who couldn't be arsed writing an email like Paula's, but feel the same way, joking aside, we do love hearing from people who enjoy the program and certainly people who are passing the message on, who are talking about what we talk about on the show in the classroom, which I know happens quite a lot. I'd love to hear more of those stories. But just in general, thank you for listening and supporting us. We've been doing it for 10 years. Still absolutely love to find out what we're going to be talking about the week and discuss about different ideas. So for everyone listening and everyone who's been downloading and supporting us, thank you very much.
I'd like to second that, and I'd like to thank Paula personally, because I think people send in emails and texts and maybe they don't think that it has an impact, but like I've had a really good week. I have lots of nice things have happened to me, but this is probably the coolest thing that happened all week, and I mean that, because it's just a nice to, you know, you do work and it has value to someone. It's a really nice feeling, so thanks a lot, Paula.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you a sense that it's more than just, you know, doing your job, that you are having some sort of an impact on the world. And that is nice. I mean, we're all looking for a purpose, right? Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producing and captain of this ship, researchers Simon Keane, Steve Daunt, and Garrett Mulhall on sound. Stephen McClune will be back with more Future Proofing your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.